more than its share of cripples and beggars, hungry children and bruised women and helpless drunks. But the man with no lips was nowhere to be seen. Twice Tom spotted a man of about the right build and general appearance and took a closer look, only to see that the man's face was normal. He ended his search at the marketplace, and there was Agnes, waiting for him impatiently, her body tense and her eyes gleaming. "I've found him," she hissed. Tom felt a surge of excitement mingled with apprehension. "Where?" "He went into a cookshop down by the east gate." "Lead me there." They circled the castle to the drawbridge, went down the straight street to the east gate, then turned into a maze of alleys beneath the walls. Tom saw the cookshop a moment later. It was not even a house, just a sloping roof on four posts up against the town wall, with a huge fire at the back over which a sheep turned on a spit and a cauldron bubbled. It was now about noon, and the little place was full of people, mostly men. The smell of the meat made Tom's stomach rumble. He raked the little crowd with his eyes, fearful that the outlaw might have left in the short time it had taken them to get here. He spotted the man immediately, sitting on a stool, a little apart from the crowd, eating a bowl of stew with a spoon, holding his scarf in front of his face to hide his mouth. Tom turned away quickly so that the man should not see him. Now he had to decide how to handle this. He was angry enough to knock the outlaw down and take his purse, but the crowd would not let him walk away. He would have to explain himself, not just to bystanders, but to the sheriff. Tom was within his rights, and the fact that the thief was an outlaw meant that he would not have anyone to vouch for his honesty, whereas Tom was evidently a respectable man and a mason. But establishing all that would take time, possibly weeks if the sheriff happened to be away in another part of the county, and there might still be an accusation of breaking the king's peace if a brawl should result. No, it would be wiser to get the thief alone. The man could not stay in the town overnight, for he had no home here, and he could not get lodgings without establishing himself as a respectable man somehow. Therefore he had to leave before the gates closed at nightfall, and there were only two gates. "He'll probably go back the way he came," Tom said to Agnes. "I'll wait outside the east gate. Let Alfred watch the west gate. You stay in the town and see what the thief does. Keep Martha with you, but don't let him see her. If you need to send a message to me or Alfred, use Martha." "Right," Agnes said tersely. Alfred said, "What should I do if he comes out my way?" He sounded excited. "Nothing," Tom said firmly. "Watch which road he takes, then wait. Martha will fetch me and we'll overtake him together." Alfred looked disappointed, and Tom said, "You do as I say. I don't want to lose my son as well as my pig." Alfred nodded reluctant assent. "Let's break up before he notices us huddling together and plotting. Go." Tom left them immediately, not looking back. He could rely on Agnes to carry out the plan. He hurried to the east gate and left the town, crossing the rickety wooden bridge over which he had pushed the ox cart that morning. Directly ahead of him was the Winchester Road going east, dead straight, like a long carpet unrolled over the hills and valleys. To his left, the road by which Tom and presumably the thief had come to Salisbury, the portway, curled up over a hill and disappeared. The thief would almost certainly take the portway. Tom went down the hill and through the cluster of houses at the crossroads, then turned onto the portway. He needed to hide himself. He walked along the road looking for a suitable spot. He went 200 yards without finding anything. Looking back, he realized that this was too far. He could no longer see the faces of people at the crossroads, so that he would not know if the man with no lips came along and took the Winchester Road. He scanned the landscape again. The road was bordered on either side by ditches, which might have offered concealment in dry weather, but today were running with water. Beyond each ditch, the land rose in a hump. In the field on the south side of the road, a few cows were grazing the stubble. Tom noticed that one of the cows was lying down at the raised edge of the field, overlooking the road, partly concealed by the hump. With a sigh, he retraced his steps. He jumped the ditch and kicked the cow. It got up and went away. Tom lay down in the warm, dry patch it had left. He pulled his hood over his face and settled to wait, wishing he had had the foresight to buy some bread before leaving the town. He was anxious and a little scared. The outlaw was a smaller man, but he was fast-moving and vicious, as he had shown when he clubbed Martha and stole the pig. Tom was a little afraid of being hurt, but much more worried that he might not get his money. He hoped Agnes and Martha were all right. Agnes could look after herself, he knew, and even if the outlaw spotted her, what could the man do? He would just be on his guard, that was all. From where he lay, Tom could see the towers of the cathedral. He wished he had had a moment to look inside. He was curious about the treatment of the piers of the arcade. These were usually fat pillars, each with arches sprouting from its top, two arches going north and south to connect with the neighboring pillars in the arcade, and one going east or west across the side aisle. It was an ugly effect, for there was something not quite right about an arch that sprang from the top of a round column. When Tom built his cathedral, each pier would be a cluster of shafts, with an arch springing from the top of each shaft, an elegantly logical arrangement. He began to visualize the decoration of the arches. Geometric shapes were the commonest forms. It did not take much skill to carve zigzags and lozenges. But Tom liked foliage, which lent softness and a touch of nature to the hard regularity of the stones. The imaginary cathedral occupied his mind until mid-afternoon, when he saw the slight figure and blonde head of Martha come skipping across the bridge and through the houses. She hesitated at the crossing, then picked the right road. Tom watched her walk toward him, seeing her frown as she began to wonder where he could be. As she drew level with him, he called her softly, "Martha." She gave a little squeal, then saw him and ran to him, jumping over the ditch. "Mummy sent you this," she said, and took something from inside her cloak. It was a hot meat pie. "By the cross, your mother's a good woman," said Tom, and took a mammoth bite. It was made with beef and onions, and it tasted heavenly. Martha squatted beside Tom on the grass. "This is what happened to the man who stole our pig," she said. She screwed up her nose and concentrated on remembering what she had been told to say. She was so sweet that she took Tom's breath away. "He came out to the cook shop and met a lady with a painted face and went to her house. We waited outside." "While the outlaw spent our money on a whore," Tom thought bitterly. "Go on."
"He was not long in the lady's house, and when he came out, he went to an alehouse. He's there now. He doesn't drink much, but he plays at dice."
"I hope he wins," Tom said grimly. "Is that it?"
"That's all."
"Are you hungry?"
"I had a bun."
"Have you told Alfred all this?"
"Not yet. I'm to go to him next."
"Tell him he must try to stay dry."
"Try to stay dry," she repeated.
"Shall I say that before or after telling him about the man who stole our pig?"
It did not matter, of course. "After," Tom said, as she wanted a definite answer. He smiled at her. "You're a clever girl. Off you go."
"I like this game," she said.
She waved and left, her girlish legs twinkling as she jumped the ditch daintily and ran back toward the town. Tom watched her with love and anger in his heart. He and Agnes had worked hard to get money to feed their children, and he was ready to kill to get back what had been stolen from them. Perhaps the outlaw would be ready to kill, too. Outlaws were outside the law, as the name implied. They lived in unconstrained violence. This might not be the first time Pharamond Openmouth had come up against one of his victims. He was nothing if not dangerous. The daylight began to fade surprisingly early, as it sometimes did on wet autumn afternoons. Tom started to worry whether he would recognize the thief in the rain. As evening closed in, the traffic to and from the town thinned out, for most visitors had left in time to reach their home villages by nightfall. The lights of candles and lanterns began to flicker in the higher houses of the town and in the suburban hovels. Tom wondered, pessimistically, if the thief might stay overnight after all. Perhaps he had dishonest friends in the town who would put him up even though they knew he was an outlaw. Perhaps. Then Tom saw a man with a scarf across his mouth. He was walking across the wooden bridge close to two other men. It suddenly occurred to Tom that the thief's two accomplices, the bald one and the man in the green hat, might have come to Salisbury with him. Tom had not seen either of them in the town, but the three might have separated for a while and then joined up again for the return journey. Tom cursed under his breath. He did not think he could fight three men. But as they came closer, the group separated, and Tom realized with relief that they were not together after all. The first two were father and son, two peasants with dark, close-set eyes and hooked noses. They took the portway, and the man with the scarf followed. He studied the thief's gait as he came closer. He appeared sober. That was a pity. Glancing back to the town, he saw a woman and a girl emerge onto the bridge, Agnes and Martha. He was dismayed. He had not envisaged their being present when he confronted the thief. However, he realized that he had given no instructions to the contrary. He tensed as they all came up the road toward him. Tom was so big that most people gave in to him in a confrontation, but outlaws were desperate and there was no telling what might happen in a fight. The two peasants went by, mildly merry, talking about horses. Tom took his iron-headed hammer from his belt and hefted it in his right hand. He hated thieves, who did no work but took the bread from good people. He would have no qualms about hitting this one with a hammer. The thief seemed to slow down as he came near, almost as if he sensed danger. Tom waited until he was 4 or 5 yards away, too near to run back, too far to run past. Then Tom rolled over the bank, sprang across the ditch, and stood in his way. The man stopped dead and stared at him. "What's this?" he said nervously. "He doesn't recognize me," Tom thought. He said, "You stole my pig yesterday and sold it to a butcher today." "I never—" "Don't deny it," Tom said. "Just give me the money you got for it and I won't hurt you." For a moment he thought the thief was going to do just that. He felt a sense of anticlimax as the man hesitated. Then the thief turned on his heel and ran, straight into Agnes. He was not traveling fast enough to knock her over, and she was a woman who took a lot of knocking over. And the two of them staggered from side to side for a moment in a clumsy dance. Then he realized she was deliberately obstructing him, and he pushed her aside. She stuck out her leg as he went past her. Her foot got between his knees, and both of them fell down. Tom's heart was in his mouth as he raced to her side. The thief was getting up, with one knee on her back. Tom grabbed his collar and yanked him off her. He hauled him to the side of the road before he could regain his balance, then threw him into the ditch. Agnes stood up. Martha ran to her. Tom said rapidly, "All right?" "Yes," Agnes answered. The two peasants had stopped and turned around, and they were staring at the scene, wondering what was going on. The thief was on his knees in the ditch. "He's an outlaw," Agnes called out to them, to discourage them from interfering. "He stole our pig." The peasants made no reply, but waited to see what would happen next. Tom spoke to the thief again. "Give me my money, and I'll let you go." The man came up out of the ditch with a knife in his hand, fast as a rat, and went for Tom's throat. Agnes screamed. Tom dodged. The knife flashed across his face, and he felt a burning pain along his jaw. He stepped back and swung his hammer as the knife flashed again. The thief jumped back, and both knife and hammer swished through the damp evening air without connecting. For an instant, the two men stood still, facing one another, breathing hard. Tom's cheek hurt. He realized they were evenly matched, for although Tom was bigger, the thief had a knife which was a deadlier weapon than a mason's hammer. He felt the cold grasp of fear as he realized he might be about to die. He suddenly felt he could not breathe. From the corner of his eye he saw a sudden movement. The thief saw it too, and darted a glance at Agnes, then ducked his head as a stone came flying at him from her hand. Tom reacted with the speed of a man in fear of his life, and swung his hammer at the thief's bent head. It connected just as the man was looking up again. The iron hammer struck his forehead at the hairline. It was a hasty blow and did not have all of Tom's considerable strength behind it. The thief staggered, but did not fall. Tom hit him again. This blow was harder. He had time to lift the hammer above his head and aim it, as the dazed thief tried to focus his eyes. Tom thought of Martha as he swung the hammer down. It struck with all his force, and the thief fell to the ground like a dropped doll. Tom was wound up too tightly to feel any relief. He knelt beside the thief, searching him. "Where's his purse? Where's his purse, damnation?" The limp body was difficult to move. Finally, Tom laid him flat on his back and opened his cloak. There was a big leather purse hanging from his belt. Tom undid its clasp. Inside was a soft wool bag with a drawstring. Tom pulled it out. It was light.
Empty,
Tom said. He must have another. He pulled the cloak from under the man and carefully felt it all over. There were no concealed pockets, no hard parts. He pulled off the boots. There was nothing inside them. He drew his eating knife from his belt and slit the soles. Nothing. Impatiently, he slipped his knife inside the neck of the thief's woolen tunic and ripped it to the hem. There was no hidden money belt. The thief lay in the middle of the mud road, naked but for his stockings. The two peasants were staring at Tom as if he were mad. Furiously, Tom said to Agnes, "He hasn't any money."
"He must have lost it all at dice," she said bitterly.
"I hope he burns in the fires of hell," Tom said. Agnes knelt down and felt the thief's chest.
"That's where he is now," she said. "You've killed him."
4. By Christmas they were starving. The winter came early, and it was as cold and hard and unyielding as a stonemason's iron chisel. There were still apples on the trees when the first frost dusted the fields. People called it a cold snap, thinking it would be brief, but it was not. Villages that left the autumn ploughing a little late broke their ploughshares on the rock-hard earth. The peasants hastened to kill their pigs and salt them for the winter, and the lords slaughtered their cattle because winter grazing would not support the same number of livestock as summer. But the endless freeze withered the grass, and some of the remaining animals died anyway. Wolves became desperate and came into villages at dusk to snatch away scraggy chickens and listless children. On building sites all over the country, as soon as the first frost struck, the walls that had been built that summer were hastily covered with straw and dung to insulate them from the worst cold, because the mortar in them was not yet completely dry, and if it were to freeze, it would crack. No further mortar work would be done until spring. Some of the masons had been hired for the summer only, and they went back to their home villages, where they were known as wrights rather than masons, and they would spend the winter making ploughs, saddles, harness, carts, shovels, doors, and anything else that required a skilled hand with hammer and chisel and saw. The other masons moved into the lean-to lodges on the site and cut stones in intricate shapes all the hours of daylight. But because the frost was early, the work progressed too fast, and because the peasants were starving, the bishops and castellans and lords had less money to spend on building than they had hoped, and so as the winter wore on, some of the masons were dismissed. Tom and his family walked from Salisbury to Shaftesbury, and from there to Sherborne, Wells, Bath, Bristol, Gloucester, Oxford, Wallingford, and Windsor. Everywhere the fires inside the lodges burned, and the churchyards and castle walls rang with the song of iron on stone, and the master builders made small, precise models of arches and vaults with their clever hands encased in fingerless gloves. Some masters were impatient, abrupt, or discourteous. Others looked sadly at Tom's thin children and pregnant wife, and spoke kindly and regretfully. But they all said the same thing. "No, there's no work for you here." Whenever they could, they imposed upon the hospitality of monasteries, where travellers could always get a meal of some kind and a place to sleep, strictly for one night only. When the blackberries ripened in the bramble thickets, they lived on those for days on end, like the birds. In the forest, Agnes would light a fire under the iron cooking pot and boil porridge. But still, much of the time, they were obliged to buy bread from bakers and pickled herrings from fishmongers, or to eat in alehouses and cookshops, which was more expensive than preparing their own food. And so their money inexorably drained away. Martha was naturally skinny, but she became even thinner. Alfred was still getting taller, like a weed growing in shallow soil, and he became lanky. Agnes ate sparingly, but the baby growing inside her was greedy, and Tom could see that she was tormented by hunger. Sometimes he ordered her to eat more, and then even her iron will yielded to the combined authority of her husband and her unborn child. Still, she did not grow plump and rosy as she had during other pregnancies. Instead, she looked gaunt, despite her swollen belly, like a starving child in a famine. Since leaving Salisbury, they had walked around three-quarters of a big circle, and by the end of the year they were back in the vast forest that stretched from Windsor to Southampton. They were heading for Winchester. Tom had sold his mason's tools, and all but a few pennies of that money had been spent. He would have to borrow tools, or the money to buy them, as soon as he found employment. If he did not get work in Winchester, he did not know what he would do. He had brothers back in his home town, but that was in the north, a journey of several weeks, and the family would starve before they got there. Agnes was an only child, and her parents were dead. There was no agricultural work in midwinter. Perhaps Agnes could scrape a few pennies as a scullery maid in a rich house in Winchester. She certainly could not tramp the roads much longer, for her time was near. But Winchester was 3 days away, and they were hungry now. The blackberries were gone, there was no monastery in prospect, and Agnes had no oats left in the cooking pot, which she carried on her back. The previous night they had traded a knife for a loaf of rye bread, 4 bowls of broth with no meat in it, and a place to sleep by the fire in a peasant's hovel. They had not seen a village since. But toward the end of the afternoon, Tom saw smoke rising above the trees, and they found the home of a solitary verderer, one of the king's forest police. He gave them a sack of turnips in exchange for Tom's small axe. They had walked only 3 miles farther when Agnes said she was too tired to go on. Tom was surprised. In all their years together, he had never known her to say she was too tired for anything. She sat down in the shelter of a big horse chestnut tree beside the road. Tom dug a shallow pit for a fire using a worn wooden shovel, one of the few tools they had left, for nobody would want to buy it. The children gathered twigs and Tom started the fire. Then he took the cooking pot and went to find a stream. He returned with the pot full of icy water and set it at the edge of the fire. Agnes sliced some turnips. Martha collected the conkers that had dropped from the tree, and Agnes showed her how to peel them and grind the soft insides into a coarse flour to thicken the turnip soup. Tom sent Alfred to find more firewood, while he himself took a stick and went poking around in the dead leaves on the forest floor, hoping to find a hibernating hedgehog or squirrel to put in the broth. He was unlucky. He sat down beside Agnes, while darkness fell and the soup cooked. "Have we any salt left?" he asked her. She shook her head. "You've been eating porridge without salt for weeks," she said. "Haven't you noticed?" "No." "Hunger is the best seasoning." "Well, we've plenty of that." Tom was suddenly terribly tired. He felt the crushing burden of the piled-up disappointments of the last 4 months, and he could not be brave any longer. In a defeated voice he said, "What went wrong, Agnes?"
"Everything,"
she said. "You had no work last winter. You got a job in the spring. Then the Earl's daughter cancelled the wedding and Lord William cancelled the house. Then we decided to stay and work in the harvest.
That was a mistake.
For sure it would have been easier for me to find a building job in the summer than it was in the autumn. And the winter came early. And for all that, we would still have been all right, but then our pig was stolen." Tom nodded wearily. "My only consolation is knowing that the thief is even now suffering all the torments of hell."
"I hope so."
"Do you doubt it? Priests don't know as much as they pretend to. My father was one, remember?" Tom remembered very well. One wall of her father's parish church had crumbled beyond repair, and Tom had been hired to rebuild it. Priests were not allowed to marry, but this priest had a housekeeper, and the housekeeper had a daughter, and it was an open secret in the village that the priest was the father of the girl. Agnes had not been beautiful even then, but her skin had had a glow of youth, and she had seemed to be bursting with energy. She would talk to Tom while he was working, and sometimes the wind would flatten her dress against her so that Tom could see the curves of her body, even her navel, almost as clearly as if she had been naked. One night she came to the little hut where he slept and put a hand over his mouth to tell him not to speak, and pulled off her dress so that he could see her nude in the moonlight, and then he took her strong young body in his arms and they made love. "We were both virgins," he said aloud. She knew what he was thinking about. She smiled, then her face saddened again, and she said,
It seems so long ago. Martha said, Can we eat now?
The smell of the soup was making Tom's stomach rumble. He dipped his bowl into the bubbling cauldron and brought out a few slices of turnip in a thin gruel. He used the blunt edge of his knife to test the turnip. It was not cooked all the way through, but he decided not to make them wait. He gave a bowlful to each child, then took one to Agnes. She looked drawn and thoughtful. She blew on her soup to cool it, then raised the bowl to her lips. The children quickly drained theirs and wanted more. Tom took the pot out of the fire, using the hem of his cloak to avoid burning his hands, and emptied the remaining soup into the children's bowls. When he returned to Agnes's side, she said, What about you?
I'll eat tomorrow, he said.
She seemed too tired to argue. Tom and Alfred built the fire high and gathered enough wood to last the night. Then they all rolled up in their cloaks and lay down on the leaves to sleep. Tom slept lightly, and when Agnes groaned, he woke up instantly.
What is it?
He whispered. She groaned again. Her face was pale and her eyes were closed. After a moment, she said,
The baby is coming.
Tom's heart missed a beat. Not here, he thought, not here on the frozen ground in the depths of a forest.
But it's not due, he said. It's early.
Tom made his voice calm. Have the waters broken?
Soon after we left, the Verderer's hut,
Agnes panted, not opening her eyes. Tom remembered her suddenly diving into the bushes as if to answer an urgent call of nature. And the pains?
Ever since.
It was like her to keep quiet about it. Alfred and Martha were awake. Alfred said,
What's happening?
The baby is coming,
Tom said. Martha burst into tears. Tom frowned. Could you make it back to the Verderer's hut? He asked Agnes. There they would at least have a roof and straw to lie on and someone to help. Agnes shook her head.
The baby has dropped already.
It won't be long, then.
They were in the most deserted part of the forest. They had not seen a village since morning, and the Verderer had said they would not see one all day tomorrow. That meant there was no possibility of finding a woman to act as midwife. Tom would have to deliver the baby himself, in the cold, with only the children to help, and if anything should go wrong, he had no medicines, no knowledge.
This is my fault, Tom thought. I got her with child, and I brought her into destitution. She trusted me to provide for her, and now she is giving birth in the open air in the middle of winter.
He had always despised men who fathered children and then left them to starve, and now he was no better than they. He felt ashamed.
I'm so tired,
Agnes said. I don't believe I can bring this baby into the world. I want to rest. Her face glistened in the firelight with a thin film of sweat. Tom realized he must pull himself together. He was going to have to give Agnes strength.
I'll help you, he said.
There was nothing mysterious or complicated about what was going to happen. He had watched the births of several children. The work was normally done by women, for they knew how the mother felt, and that enabled them to be more helpful. But there was no reason why a man should not do it if necessary. He must first make her comfortable, then find out how far advanced the birth was, then make sensible preparations. Then calm her and reassure her while they waited.
How do you feel?
He asked her.
Cold, she replied. Come closer to the fire, he said.
He took off his cloak and spread it on the ground, a yard from the blaze. Agnes tried to struggle to her feet. Tom lifted her easily and set her down gently on his cloak. He knelt beside her. The wool tunic she was wearing underneath her own cloak had buttons all the way down the front. He undid two of them and put his hands inside. Agnes gasped.
Does it hurt?
He said, surprised and worried.
No,
she said with a brief smile.
Your hands are cold.
He felt the outline of her belly. The swelling was higher and more pointed than it had been last night when the two of them had slept together in the straw on the floor of a peasant's hovel. Tom pressed a little harder, feeling the shape of the unborn baby. He found one end of the body just beneath Agnes's navel. But he could not locate the other end. He said, I can feel its bottom, but not its head.
That's because it's on the way out, she said.
He covered her and tucked her cloak around her. He would need to make his preparations quickly. He looked at the children. Martha was snuffling. Alfred just looked scared.
It would be good to give them something to do. Alfred, take that cooking pot to the stream. Wash it clean and bring it back full of fresh water. Martha, collect some reeds and make me 2 lengths of string, each big enough for a necklace. Quick now. You're going to have another brother or sister by daybreak. They went off. Tom took out his eating knife and a small hard stone and began to sharpen the blade. Agnes groaned again. Tom put down his knife and held her hand. He had sat with her like this when the others were born. Alfred, then Matilda, who had died after 2 years, and Martha, and the child who had been born dead, a boy whom Tom had secretly planned to name Harold. But each time there had been someone else to give help and reassurance. Agnes's mother for Alfred, a village midwife for Matilda and Harold, and the lady of the manor, no less, for Martha. This time he would have to do it alone. But he must not show his anxiety. He must make her feel happy and confident. She relaxed as the spasm passed. Tom said, "Remember when Martha was born and the Lady Isabella acted as midwife?" Agnes smiled.
"You were building a chapel for the Lord, and you asked her to send her maid to fetch the midwife from the village."
And she said, "That drunken old witch, I wouldn't let her deliver a litter of wolfhound pups." And she took us to her own chamber, and Lord Robert could not go to bed until Martha was born. She was a good woman. There aren't many ladies like her. Alfred returned with the pot full of cold water. Tom set it down near the fire, not close enough to boil, so there would be warm water. Agnes reached inside her cloak and took out a small linen bag containing clean rags, which she had ready. Martha came back with her hands full of reeds and sat down to plait them.
"What do you need strings for?"
she asked. "Something very important, you'll see," Tom said. "Make them well." Alfred looked restless and embarrassed. "Go and collect more wood," Tom told him. "Let's have a bigger fire." The boy went off, glad to have something to do. Agnes's face tautened with strain as she began to bear down again, pushing the baby out of her womb, making a low noise like a tree creaking in a gale. Tom could see that the effort was costing her dear, using up her last reserves of strength, and he wished with all his heart that he could bear down for her and take the strain himself, to give her some relief. At last the pain seemed to ease, and Tom breathed again. Agnes seemed to drift off into a doze. Alfred returned with his arms full of sticks. Agnes became alert again and said, "I'm so cold." Tom said, "Alfred, build up the fire. Martha, lie down beside your mother and keep her warm." They both obeyed with worried looks. Agnes put her arms around Martha and held her close, shivering. Tom was sick with worry. The fire was roaring, but the air was getting colder. It might be so cold that it would kill the baby with its first breath. It was not unknown for children to be born out of doors. In fact, it happened often at harvest time, when everyone was so busy and the women worked up until the last minute. But at harvest the ground was dry and the grass was soft and the air was balmy. He had never heard of a woman giving birth outside in winter. Agnes raised herself on her elbows and spread her legs wider. "What is it?" Tom said in a frightened voice. She was straining too hard to reply. Tom said, "Alfred, kneel down behind your mother and let her lean on you." When Alfred was in position, Tom opened Agnes's cloak and unbuttoned the skirt of her dress. Kneeling between her legs, he could see that the birth opening was beginning to dilate a little already. "Not long now, my darling," he murmured, struggling to keep the tremor of fear out of his voice. She relaxed again, closing her eyes and resting her weight on Alfred. The opening seemed to shrink a little. The forest was silent but for the crackling of the big fire. Suddenly Tom thought of how the outlaw woman, Ellen, had given birth in the forest alone. It must have been terrifying. She had feared that a wolf would come upon her while she was helpless and steal the newborn baby away, she had said. This year the wolves were bolder than usual, people said. But surely they would not attack a group of 4 people. Agnes tensed again, and fresh beads of sweat appeared on her contorted face. "This is it," thought Tom. He was frightened. He watched the opening widen again, and this time he could see by the light of the fire the damp black hair of the baby's head pushing through. He thought of praying, but there was no time now. Agnes began to breathe in short, fast gasps. The opening stretched wider, impossibly wide, and then the head began to come through, face down.
A moment later, Tom saw the wrinkled ears flat against the side of the baby's head. Then he saw the folded skin of the neck. He could not yet see whether the baby was normal. "The head is out," he said. But Agnes knew that already, of course, for she could feel it, and she had relaxed again. Slowly the baby turned, so that Tom could see the closed eyes and mouth, wet with blood and the slippery fluids of the womb. Martha cried, "Oh, look at its little face!" Agnes heard her and smiled briefly, then began to strain again. Tom leaned forward between her thighs and supported the tiny head with his left hand as the shoulders came out, first one, then the other. Then the rest of the body emerged in a rush, and Tom put his right hand under the baby's hips and held it as the tiny legs slithered into the cold world. Agnes's opening immediately started to close around the pulsing blue cord that came from the baby's navel. Tom lifted the baby and scrutinized it anxiously. There was a lot of blood, and at first he feared something was terribly wrong. But on closer examination he could see no injury. He looked between its legs. It was a boy.
"It looks horrible," said Martha.
"He's perfect," Tom said, and he felt weak with relief. "A perfect boy." The baby opened its mouth and cried. Tom looked at Agnes. Their eyes met, and they both smiled. Tom held the tiny baby close to his chest. "Martha, fetch me a bowl of water out of that pot." She jumped up to do his bidding. "Where are those rags, Agnes?" Agnes pointed to the linen bag lying on the ground beside her shoulder. Alfred passed it to Tom. The boy's face was running with tears. It was the first time he had seen a child born. Tom dipped a rag into a bowl of warm water and gently washed the blood and mucus off the baby's face. Agnes unbuttoned the front of her tunic, and Tom put the baby in her arms. He was still squalling. As Tom watched, the blue cord that went from the baby's belly to Agnes's groin stopped pulsing and shriveled, turning white. Tom said to Martha, "Give me those strings you made. Now you'll see what they're for." She passed him the two lengths of plaited reeds. He tied them around the birth cord in two places, pulling the knots tight. Then he used his knife to cut the cord between the knots. He sat back on his haunches. They had done it. The worst was over and the baby was well. He felt proud. Agnes moved the baby so that his face was at her breast. His tiny mouth found her enlarged nipple, and he stopped crying and started to suck. Martha said in an amazed voice,
"How does he know he should do that?"
"It's a mystery," said Tom. He handed the bowl to her and said, "Get your mother some fresh water to drink."
"Oh, yes," said Agnes gratefully,
as if she had just realized she was desperately thirsty. Martha brought the water, and Agnes drank the bowl dry.
"That was wonderful," she said. "Thank you."
She looked down at the suckling baby, then up at Tom.
"You're a good man," she said quietly. "I love you."
Tom felt tears come to his eyes. He smiled at her, then dropped his gaze. He saw that she was still bleeding a lot. The shriveled birth cord, which was still slowly coming out, lay curled in a pool of blood on Tom's cloak between Agnes's legs. He looked up again. The baby had stopped suckling and fallen asleep. Agnes pulled her cloak over him, and then her own eyes closed. After a moment, Martha said to Tom,
"Are you waiting for something?"
"The afterbirth," Tom told her.
"What's that?"
"You'll see." Mother and baby dozed for a while, then Agnes opened her eyes again. Her muscles tensed. Her opening dilated a little, and the placenta emerged. Tom picked it up in his hands and looked at it. It was like something on a butcher's slab. Looking more closely, he saw that it seemed to be torn, as if there were a piece missing. But he had never looked this closely at an afterbirth, and he supposed they were always like this, for they must always have broken away from the womb. He put the thing on the fire. It made an unpleasant smell as it burned, but if he had thrown it away it might have attracted foxes or even a wolf. Agnes was still bleeding. Tom remembered that there was always a rush of blood with the afterbirth, but he did not recall so much. He realized that the crisis was not yet over. He felt faint for a moment from strain and lack of food, but the spell passed and he pulled himself together.
"You're still bleeding a little," he said to Agnes, trying not to sound as worried as he was.
"It will stop soon," she said. "Cover me."
Tom buttoned the skirt of her dress, then wrapped her cloak around her legs. Alfred said, "Can I have a rest now?" He was still kneeling behind Agnes, supporting her. He must be numb, Tom thought, from staying so long in the same position. "I'll take your place," Tom said. Agnes would be more comfortable with the baby if she could stay half upright, he thought, and also a body behind her would keep her back warm and shield her from the wind. He changed places with Alfred. Alfred grunted with pain as he stretched his young legs. Tom wrapped his arms around Agnes and the baby. "How do you feel?" he asked her. "Just tired." The baby cried. Agnes moved him so that he could find her nipple. As he suckled, she seemed to sleep. Tom was uneasy. It was normal to be tired, but there was a lethargy about Agnes that bothered him. She was too weak. The baby slept, and after a while the other two children fell asleep. Martha curled up beside Agnes, and Alfred stretched out on the far side of the fire. Tom held Agnes in his arms, stroking her gently. Every now and again he would kiss the top of her head. He felt her body relax as she fell into a deeper and deeper sleep. It was probably the best thing for her, he decided. He touched her cheek. Her skin was clammy despite all his efforts to keep her warm. He reached inside her cloak and touched the baby's chest. The child was warm and his heart was beating strongly. Tom smiled. "A tough baby," he thought. "A survivor." Agnes stirred.
"Tom?"
"Yes?"
"Do you remember the night I came to you? In your lodge?
When you were working on my father's church?"
"Of course," he said, patting her. "How could I ever forget?"
"I never regretted giving myself to you. Never for one moment. Every time I think of that night, I feel so glad."
He smiled. That was good to know.
"Me too," he said. "I'm glad you did."
She dozed for a while, then spoke again.
"I hope you build your cathedral," she said.
He was surprised. "I thought you were against it."
"I was, but I was wrong. You deserve something beautiful."
He did not know what she meant.
"Build a beautiful cathedral for me," she said.
She was not making sense. He was glad when she fell asleep again. This time her body went quite limp and her head leaned sideways. Tom had to support the baby to prevent him falling off her chest. They lay like that for a long time. Eventually the baby woke again and cried. Agnes did not respond. The crying woke Alfred, and he rolled over and looked at his baby brother. Tom shook Agnes gently.
"Wake up," he said. "The baby wants to feed."
"Father?"
said Alfred in a scared voice.
"Look at her face."
Tom was filled with foreboding. She had bled too much.
"Agnes," he said, "wake up."
There was no response. She was unconscious. He got up, easing her back, until she lay flat on the ground. Her face was ghastly white. Dreading what he would see, he unwrapped the folds of the cloak from around her thighs. There was blood everywhere. Alfred gasped and turned away. Tom whispered, "Christ Jesus, save us." The baby's crying woke Martha. She saw the blood and began to scream. Tom picked her up and smacked her face. She became silent.
"Don't scream," he said calmly, and put her down again.
Alfred said, "Is mother dying?" Tom put his hand on Agnes's chest, just underneath her left breast. There was no heartbeat. No heartbeat. He pressed harder. Her flesh was warm, and the underside of her heavy breast touched his hand. But she was not breathing, and there was no heartbeat. A numb coldness settled over Tom like a fog. She was gone. He stared at her face. How could she not be there? He willed her to move, to open her eyes, to draw breath. He kept his hand on her chest. Sometimes a heart might start again, people said, but she had lost so much blood. He looked at Alfred.
"Mother is dead," he whispered.
Alfred stared at him dumbly. Martha began to cry. The new baby was crying too.
"I must take care of them," Tom thought. I must be strong for them. But he wanted to weep, to put his arms around her and hold her body while it cooled, and remember her as a girl, and laughing and making love. He wanted to sob with rage and shake his fist at the merciless heavens. He hardened his heart. He had to stay controlled. He had to be strong for the children. No tears came to his eyes. He thought, "What do I do first? Dig a grave. I must dig a deep hole, and lay her in it to keep the wolves off and preserve her bones until the day of judgment, and then say a prayer for her soul. Oh, Agnes, why have you left me alone?" The new baby was still crying. His eyes were screwed tightly shut, and his mouth opened and closed rhythmically, as if he could get sustenance from the air. He needed feeding. Agnes's breasts were full of warm milk. "Why not?" thought Tom. He shifted the baby toward her breast. The child found a nipple and sucked. Tom pulled Agnes's cloak tighter around the baby. Martha was watching wide-eyed, sucking her thumb. Tom said to her, "Could you hold the baby there so he doesn't fall?" She nodded and knelt beside the dead woman and the baby. Tom picked up the spade. She had chosen this spot to rest, and she had sat under the branches of the chestnut tree. Let this be her last resting place, then. He swallowed hard, fighting an urge to sit on the ground and weep. He marked a rectangle on the ground some yards from the trunk of the tree, where there would be no roots near the surface. Then he began to dig. He found it helped. When he concentrated on driving his shovel into the hard ground and lifting the earth, the rest of his mind went blank, and he was able to retain his composure. He took turns with Alfred, for he, too, could take comfort in repetitious physical labor. They dug fast, driving themselves hard, and despite the bitter cold air, they both sweated as if it were noon. A time came when Alfred said, "Isn't this enough?" Tom realized that he was standing in a hole almost as deep as he was tall. He did not want the job to be finished. He nodded reluctantly. "It will do," he said. He clambered out. Dawn had broken while he was digging. Martha had picked up the baby and was sitting by the fire, rocking it. Tom went to Agnes and knelt down. He wrapped her cloak tightly around her, leaving her face visible, then picked her up. He walked over to the grave and put her down beside it. Then he climbed into the hole. He lifted her down and laid her gently on the earth. He looked at her for a long moment, kneeling there beside her in the cold grave. He kissed her lips once, softly. Then he closed her eyes. He climbed out of the grave. "Come here, children," he said. Alfred and Martha came and stood either side of him, Martha holding the baby. Tom put an arm around each of them. They looked into the grave. Tom said, "Say, 'God bless Mother.'" They both said, "God bless Mother." Martha was sobbing, and there were tears in Alfred's eyes. Tom hugged them both and swallowed his tears. He released them and picked up the shovel. Martha screamed when he threw the first shovelful of earth into the grave. Alfred put his arms around his sister. Tom kept on shoveling. He could not bear to throw earth on her face, so he covered her feet, then her legs and body, and piled the earth so high that it formed a mound, and every shovelful slid downward until at last there was earth on her neck, then over the mouth he had kissed, and finally her face disappeared, never to be seen again. He filled the grave up quickly. When it was done, he stood looking at the mound. "Goodbye, dear," he whispered. "You were a good wife, and I love you." With an effort, he turned away. His cloak was still on the ground where Agnes had lain on it to give birth. The lower half of it was sodden with congealed and drying blood. He took his knife and roughly cut the cloak in half. He threw the bloodied portion on the fire. Martha was still holding the baby. "Give him to me," Tom said. She gazed at him with fear in her eyes. He wrapped the naked baby in the clean half of the cloak and laid it on the grave. The baby cried. He turned to the children. They were staring at him dumbly. He said, "We have no milk to keep the baby alive,
so he must lie here with his mother.
Martha said, "But he'll die."
"Yes," Tom said, controlling his voice tightly. "Whatever we do, he will die." He wished the baby would stop crying. He collected their possessions and put them in the cooking pot, then strapped the pot to his back the way Agnes always did. "Let's go," he said. Martha began to sob. Alfred was white-faced. They set off down the road in the grey light of a cold morning. Eventually the sound of the baby crying faded to nothing. It was no good to stay by the grave, for the children would be unable to sleep there, and no purpose would be served by an all-night vigil. Besides, it would do them all good to keep moving. Tom set a fast pace, but his thoughts were now free, and he could no longer control them. There was nothing to do but walk. No arrangements to make, no jobs to do, nothing to be organized, nothing to look at but the gloomy forest and the shadows fidgeting in the light of the torches. He would think of Agnes, and follow the trail of some memory and smile to himself, then turn to tell her what he had remembered. Then the shock of realizing that she was dead would strike like a physical pain. He felt bewildered, as if something totally incomprehensible had happened, although of course it was the most ordinary thing in the world for a woman of her age to die in childbirth, and for a man of his age to be left a widower. But the sense of loss was like a wound. He had heard that people who had the toes chopped off one foot could not stand up, but fell over constantly until they learned to walk again. He felt like that, as if part of him had been amputated, and he could not get used to the idea that it was gone forever. He tried not to think about her, but he kept remembering how she had looked before she died. It seemed incredible that she had been alive just a few hours ago, and now she was gone. He pictured her face as she strained to give birth, and then her proud smile as she looked at the baby boy. He recalled what she had said to him afterward. "I hope you build your cathedral." And then, "Build a beautiful cathedral for me." She had spoken as if she knew she was dying. As he walked on, he thought more and more about the baby he had left wrapped in half a cloak, lying on top of a new grave. He was probably still alive, unless a fox had smelled him already. He would die before morning, however. He would cry for a while, then close his eyes, and his life would slip away as he grew cold in his sleep. Unless a fox smelled him. There was nothing Tom could do for the baby. He needed milk to survive, and there was none. No villages where Tom could seek a wet nurse, no sheep or goat or cow that could provide the nearest equivalent. All Tom had to give him were turnips, and they would kill him as surely as the fox. As the night wore on, it seemed to him more and more dreadful that he had abandoned the baby. It was a common enough thing, he knew. Peasants with large families and small farms often exposed babies to die, and sometimes the priest turned a blind eye. But Tom did not belong to that kind of people. He should have carried it in his arms until it died, and then buried it. There was no purpose to that, of course, but all the same it would have been the right thing to do. He realized that it was daylight. He stopped, suddenly. The children stood still and stared at him, waiting. They were ready for anything. Nothing was normal anymore. "I shouldn't have left the baby," Tom said. Alfred said, "But we can't feed him. He's bound to die." "Still, I shouldn't have left him," Tom said. Martha said, "Let's go back." Still, Tom hesitated. To go back now would be to admit he had done wrong to abandon the baby. But it was true. He had done wrong. He turned around. "All right," he said. "We'll go back." Now all the dangers which he had earlier tried to discount suddenly seemed more probable. For sure a fox had smelled the baby by now and dragged him off to its lair, or even a wolf. The wild boars were dangerous even though they did not eat meat. And what about the owls? An owl could not carry off a baby, but it might peck out its eyes. He walked faster, feeling light-headed with exhaustion and starvation. Martha had to run to keep up with him, but she did not complain. He dreaded what he might see when he returned to the grave. Predators were merciless, and they could tell when a living creature was helpless.
He was not sure how far they had walked. He had lost his sense of time. The forest on either side looked unfamiliar, even though he had just passed through it. He looked anxiously for the place where the grave was. Surely the fire could not have gone out yet. They had built it so high. He scrutinized the trees, looking for the distinctive leaves of the horse chestnut. They passed a side turning, which he did not remember, and he began to wonder crazily whether he could possibly have passed the grave already and not seen it. Then he thought he saw a faint orange glow ahead. His heart seemed to falter. He quickened his step and narrowed his eyes. Yes, it was a fire. He broke into a run. He heard Martha cry out, as if she thought he was leaving her, and he called over his shoulder, "We're there!" and heard the two children running after him. He drew level with the horse chestnut tree, his heart pounding in his chest. The fire was burning merrily. There was the pile of firewood. There was the blood-stained patch of ground where Agnes had bled to death. There was the grave, a mound of freshly dug earth under which she now lay. And on the grave was nothing. Tom looked around frantically, his mind in a turmoil. There was no sign of the baby. Tears of frustration came to Tom's eyes. Even the half a cloak the baby had been wrapped in had disappeared. Yet the grave was undisturbed. There were no animal tracks in the soft earth, no blood, no marks to indicate that the baby had been dragged away. Tom began to feel as if he could not see very clearly. It became difficult to think straight. He knew now that he had done a dreadful thing in leaving the baby while it was still alive. When he knew it was dead, he would be able to rest. But it might still be alive somewhere, somewhere nearby. He decided to circle around and look. Alfred said, "Where are you going?" "We must search for the baby," he said without looking back. He walked around the edge of the little clearing, looking under the bushes, still feeling slightly dizzy and faint. He saw nothing, not even a clue to the direction in which the wolf might have taken the baby. He was now sure it was a wolf. The creature's lair might be nearby. "We must circle wider," he said to the children. He led them around again, moving farther from the fire, pushing through bushes and undergrowth. He was beginning to feel confused, but he managed to keep his mind focused on one thing, the imperative need to find the baby. He felt no grief now, just a fierce, raging determination, and in the back of his mind, the appalling knowledge that all of this was his fault. He blundered through the forest, raking the ground with his eyes, stopping every few paces to listen for the unmistakable wailing monotone of a newborn baby. But when he and the children were quiet, the forest was silent. He lost track of time. His ever-increasing circles brought him back to the road at intervals for a while, but later he realized that it seemed a long time since they crossed it. At one point he wondered why he had not come across the verdurer's cottage. It occurred to him vaguely that he had lost his way, and might no longer be circling around the grave, but instead wandering through the forest more or less at random. But it did not really matter, so long as he kept searching. "Father," Alfred said. Tom looked at him, irritated by the interruption of his concentration. Alfred was carrying Martha, who appeared to be fast asleep on his back. Tom said, "What?" "Can we rest?" Alfred said. Tom hesitated. He did not want to stop, but Alfred looked about to collapse. "All right," he said reluctantly, "but not for long." They were on a slope. There might be a stream at its foot. He was thirsty. He took Martha from Alfred and picked his way down the slope, cradling her in his arms. As he expected, he found a small, clear stream with ice at its edges. He put Martha down on the bank. She did not wake. He and Alfred knelt and scooped up the cold water in their hands. Alfred lay down next to Martha and closed his eyes. Tom looked around him. He was in a clearing carpeted with fallen leaves. The trees all around were low, stout oaks, their bare branches intertwining overhead. Tom crossed the clearing, thinking of looking for the baby behind the trees, but when he reached the other side his legs went weak and he was obliged to sit down abruptly. It was full daylight now, but misty, and it seemed no warmer than midnight. He was shivering uncontrollably. He realized he had been walking around wearing only his under tunic. He wondered what had happened to his cloak, but he could not remember. Either the mist thickened, or something strange happened to his vision, for he could not see the children on the far side of the clearing any longer. He wanted to get up and go to them, but there was something wrong with his legs. After a while, a weak sun broke through the cloud, and soon after that,